And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and my guest this week is Richard Lang. Lang is a former magazine editor and currently a writer of literary crime fiction. His novels are This Wicked World and Angel Baby, which just won the Hammett Prize. And he's published two collections of short stories, Dead Boys, and the book we'll talk about today, Sweet Nothing, which is available from Mulholland Books. Richard, most of the stories in Sweet Nothing are set in Southern California. Are you native to the area?
I'm native to California, but I grew up in the part of California that a lot of people don't think about when they think about California,
which
is the Central Valley and its agriculture, its oil fields, farming. And so I lived in a lot of small towns up and down that valley growing up until I was about 17. And I came to LA when I was 17 to go to school, to college, and I've been there ever since. I've lived in New York for a little bit. I lived in Barcelona for a little bit. Traveled a lot, sometimes extended periods, but I've always come back to Los Angeles. I don't know. As soon as I hit the town, there was something about it that I knew resonated with me, and I still feel that way. I still love it. So I guess at this point, as much as anybody, I could be considered a native of the city.
And in your stories, except for one brush with a famous actor, it's about regular people living their lives in Los Angeles.
Well, that's because that's who I know there. You know, I don't know stars. I don't know famous screenwriters. I don't know any doctors. I don't know any lawyers.
But how many junkies and degenerate gamblers do you know?
Fortunately or unfortunately, that's where my scale goes. That's kind of the world I came out of. Of course, you know, I was always the guy who had the 9-to-5 job and couldn't really, for one reason or another, didn't want to or was unable to go off the edge like that. But LA is a place where there's a lot of extreme personalities, you know, where you have a lot of people come there to do something, and the kind of people that will make that move from across the country, from across the world, to try to attain the dream, whatever that is in LA, you know, it can be to be an actor, to be a screenwriter, to be a famous chef, just to own your own push cart, you know, and not have the mob, you know, pushing the Guatemalan, you know, gangs pushing you around. For whatever reason that people come to LA, it draws a certain type, which is, I think, one reason that I tend to deal with extremes in there, because you do get the type of people that come exhibits extreme behavior at times. And so I don't have to go very far to find the material that I write about. But I do keep it to normal people because normal, you know, I'm making quote marks in the air, because that is the world that I see when I walk out my door. I don't live in Beverly Hills or Santa Monica by the beach. I live inland, near downtown. That's just the environment that's around me. And I tend to write, maybe it's laziness, but I tend to write what I see when I walk out my front door.
Now, growing up in the Central Valley, you know, we got Bakersfield and Fresno and going up to Stockton.
Absolutely.
Up in the north. They were some really tough towns, and Stockton is still pretty darn dangerous. How does that kind of danger in the Central Valley compare to the danger of Southern California?
You know, I'm used to the danger of Southern California. I don't find it dangerous. I feel completely comfortable in every neighborhood in Los Angeles just because I've been there so long. And I know where not to go. But if I found myself in that place, I would also know how to behave in order not to have that trouble. I was a kid in the Central Valley, and you experience that stuff in a different way when you're there. And those are all rough towns, as you say. And I had a string of stepdads. We basically were chasing stepfathers from Stockton to Bakersfield, and finally I got away and came to LA. So we were moving south down the valley, and you know, they were welders and construction guys, so, you know, all rough people. And I saw a rougher side of things as a child, but, you know, I always tell people that I had an unhappy childhood, but I wasn't an unhappy child, because early on I sort of found stuff to escape to, whether it was books or television or movies. You know, I kind of built my own world. So even though it might have been a little dangerous, I mean, it's weird for me coming here, you know, to Memphis, for example, because here's a city that I don't know the codes in and, you know, the secret languages of the city. So it's fun in a way, but also a little bit scary because, you know, I don't know what, when it comes to streets, I don't know where I shouldn't go. And when it comes to talking to people, you know, there's a different way of interacting than there is in LA. But, you know, as I said, in LA, I'm an expert. I know everything. And the Central Valley, I'm pretty good, you know, growing up there. I still, when I'm traveling around there, I'll go into a bar or something and, you know, wonder, like, you know, should I be in here? You know, but I can usually talk my way out of any trouble.
In Memphis, it's a bit different like Los Angeles because the neighborhoods are fairly small and close together. So you transition from one socioeconomic status to another just in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, it's amazing. Similar in L.A. where I live, because I live in a place called Echo Park Silver Lake. It used to be famous for a combination of gays and Mexican gangs. Gradually, in the time I've lived there, 25 years or so, both groups have gotten priced out.
Yeah, Silver Lake is awfully gentrified now.
Yeah,
isn't it?
No, I mean it's insane how gentrified it is in the last 10 years in particular. And so I used to see brown women pushing brown babies in strollers, and now I see brown women pushing white babies in strollers. Now we have nannies, and if you drive down my street, it's like Mercedes and Audi. It's like, what happened here? You know, I mean, I'm still the same, but the neighborhood's changing. I couldn't afford to live there now if I hadn't bought my house, a long time ago. I mean, it's a natural progression, but speaking to your point, I can go 4 blocks from my house, and I could buy crack. I could get shot. I could pick up a prostitute. Right next to my neighborhood is Westlake neighborhood, which is around MacArthur Park, and that's a notoriously dangerous, still gang-ridden area. So at least where I live, you can do that, which is reflected in the stories. I still am pretty close to the street, also actively sort of seeking it out, but I'm closer to the street than, say, someone who lives in Beverly Hills or someone who lives in Santa Monica who has to drive further to get to what I would call the fun. That's just me.
And you can kind of see that in the stories, too, because the stories aren't necessarily about the crimes themselves. Often it's about the effects of the crimes, even many years after, or people who are on the periphery of the action itself.
Yeah, it's strange, the characters that I choose to focus on. And in Dead Boys, my first book of short stories, it was a similar character. It was a disaffected white male of a certain age. All the stories were told in first person. There was a similarity to the stories that actually I didn't really notice because I wrote them over 10 years and was sending them out. It was only when they got put together as a collection, I said, oh, this is like, there's something thematic here about what's going on. And reviewers pointed out, some positively, some negatively, like, oh, hey, this guy does one thing. So when I set out to write the second collection of stories, which is Sweet Nothing, I consciously wanted to try out new voices and new perspectives, ways of looking at things. I don't know. I think it's just more interesting to me, the people who are looking in, from the outside at this. And what it mainly means is they're choosing whether or not to be involved, to get further involved in these things, the bad things that are going on. And a lot of my writing is about choices either being made or choices that were made in the past that have led to the situation you're in. And there's a lot of regret because a lot of people make bad choices in the stories, which people point out, like, in the novels and in the stories, these people make awful choices. And it's like, have you not? People do that. I mean, I've made bad choices and I've known people who make bad choices. And to me, they're not such a strange, odd bunch of people. They're familiar in a lot of ways, A, because I created them, and B, because they're based on things that I've either known, done, heard about.
Well, how was it for you writing across gender and culture?
It was interesting. I mean, it was scary, to sit down and try to do that and to channel in. And for me, the secret was, for example, one of the stories is about a 50-year-old Mexican-American woman who lives in Los Angeles. And that one is actually a first-person story told in her voice. And when I sat down to do that, I never said, what would Blanca do in this situation? I said, what would I do? And that's what I tend to do with all my characters. I'm not sitting even the villains in the novels and everybody in there. I never think of them as I'm creating a character. I'm really just projecting myself into it. I guess it's kind of like method acting or something. It's not fun all the time because some of these people are pretty awful. And so you're tapping into tapping into my own inner awfulness. I always think of, someone once told me, that when you dream of your mom. But that's not your mom in the dream. That is your creation, projection of your mom. And that's what I think about, all these characters when I'm doing them. They're all, if I look through those characters, and even that Mexican-American woman, there's a story set in 1899 France, and those are all thoughts or thought processes that I've gone through separately from the fiction, and they show up in the fiction and makes them almost like they're almost emotional diaries in a way sometimes. I can go back and, you know, to the reader, it's a story, but to me, all of those stories have like either emotional or factual underpinnings that make them like diaries to me. So, like I said, I think it's like method acting. It's not like I'm trying. It's a natural empathy that I'm able to utilize, luckily, when I do the fiction.
And it's that sense of empathy that really plays off in that story, the Wolf of Bordeaux. 1899, a man has been accused of killing children in the area, and the story is about the guard who has to guard him in the local prison, and he isn't supposed to talk to him, but what else do you do for 8-12 hours a day?
That's an interesting story, too. The genesis of that one was that for some reason, they asked me to be writer-in-residence in Bordeaux for a month. And so I said, sure, you know, they'll give me an apartment, an envelope full of euros. And so I said, well, do I have to turn in something? Like, what's the catch here? And they're like, no, you just come and you write and you enjoy Bordeaux. And I'm like, that's a great deal. But unfortunately, I'm such a worker bee from my old life, you know. I mean, I worked a 9-to-5 job until 7 years ago in magazine publishing. And so, and when I stopped that, I kind of kept the routines of that. So I write to a schedule. And I just ended up keeping the same schedule going there. And while I was there, they thought they had a serial killer at work. A lot of young college-age boys were drowning in the big river that runs through town. And while I was there, this the course of this month, there was this investigation. And it turned out that, you know, they thought someone was pushing the kids off in the river. It turned out they were just basically drunk college students falling into the river, trying to swim across it or whatever. But, you know, for a moment, there was this frisson of like, wow, we have a serial killer. And that kind of led to this story because someone showed me the old prison. And I just started basically what I do with any story, started putting together the little pieces and then finding the voice that I wanted to tell it in. And I'm not talking to the killer. I'm talking to someone who's on the periphery of this and watching this, yet in a weird way, ends up having this empathetic relationship. I mean, it's not that he likes him or anything like that, but that he begins to understand certain things about himself that maybe we all have in common. You know, even a child killer and a prison guard have things in common.
And it's that series of negations at the beginning of the story where people don't want to hear about it. They tell him not to think about it. And it's just all this negativity that's coming from the people that should be his support system
exactly. That
kind of puts him in that position.
Yeah, he's alone, you know, with this guy and himself, you know, because he goes through a bunch of soul searching, you know, about how to treat this guy. He's a psychopathic child killer. And so how do you treat him? Does this guy deserve mercy? Does he deserve compassion? And he wrestles with it, you know, all the way through to the end of the story. I don't know if, you know, it's ever truly resolved what the feeling was, which is fine with me. But some people don't like that. But I tend to like to leave things a little more open and let the reader work it out for themselves. That was an interesting thing for me to do, to try to write about the past, to try to write about a country that I know nothing about. And that's why I kept it in prison, because it's small. I didn't have to know it, because I really like to know what I write about. So I just learned a few things really well to write that one.
He does have a bit of a backup net in his thought in guarding this man, because some people try to lynch him before the process is through. And he says no. But he knows he's going to get executed anyway.
Yeah.
He knows that end is coming. So he can make some moral stand because he knows justice will be served. It just happens a couple of days later.
Right. And, well, you know, as he says, like, I am not the guy who can mete out justice, you know. That is a math done by different people than me. He says by smarter people than me. My job is this, to watch this man until whatever this process is going on out here happens. He's trying to keep it very simple. Of course, it's getting more and more complex as the more and more that he sort of converses with this guy and tries to figure him out. And, you know, he's always frustrated trying to figure him out because the guy changes his backstory and says awful things to him. So he's really trying to hold to this concept of, I'm a guard, this is what I do, you know, you can't kill him until they do. But yet inside, he's having these battles about that role.
There was a story in Jim Shepherd's last collection about Gilles de Rais, and who was an associate of Joan of Arc's, but he was a horrific child murderer and molester, but he was a nobleman. And so he had servants
who would carry out his bidding for him and bring him children.
Wow.
And the story is about one of the guys who was his servants.
Wow. And so yeah, I have to read that one. I haven't read that one. That's interesting.
Now, of course, with that, the state is the implement of violence. You know, a lot of people think that the state has the monopoly on violence. And, of course, Los Angeles kind of kicked off the conversation in modern America about police violence with the Rodney King beating. With the most recent round of people looking at police violence against citizens in America, especially African-American men, how do you see what's going on in the L.A. area right now about that?
Well, right now it's pretty calm in Los Angeles. Just the day I left, they said that there's been a rise in crime. So that could lead to some cracking down. But the new police chief has tried to implement a lot of let's get into the community. And, you know, they call it community policing. And we're not just going to be this jackbooted authoritarian kind of police force, which the LAPD was known for being forever. I'm sure if you ask a black guy or a Mexican guy in L.A., they'd have a lot different thoughts on this, you know, because I'm the most privileged kind of person to live in L.A., so I have zero contact with police ever. You know, I mean, maybe you get pulled over for speeding once in a while, but I imagine that people who deal with it every day, deal with the kind of things that go on, and it does go on, would have a lot to say about it. Those riots were scary. I mean, I was right in the middle of the Rodney King riots. I lived in the Silver Lake area then, and the riots came up Vermont Avenue from South Central, and we could sit in our apartment and look down and just watch the fires coming north, you know, as the riots were done. I was working in Beverly Hills for Larry Flint then. So at noon on Wednesday or whatever, the riots, they just closed. They said, they're coming this way. Everybody go home. So we had to drive from the west side all the way back to the east side through this kind of panic-stricken city. The first place we stopped was a liquor store to buy a couple cases of beer and some, you know, Fritos or something, you know, supplies. But you could see as we left Beverly Hills, there was a cordon of police, and there was no way that anybody was going to get into Beverly Hills, which the rest of the city didn't have that luxury.
Beverly Hills is its own city,
right? It has its own police force. They had every way in and out of there blocked off, and there was no way anybody was going to come in there. But once you got on the other side of the line, things got a little dicey. And so luckily we made it home. It was an exciting ride home and, a strange couple of days to see the city erupt like that. And it started out as with some kind of social justice roots, but then it ended up just becoming looting stores. And you could see these people there was no political motive besides probably some internalized rage or anger, but they were victimizing the small business people. And that was sad to watch because you don't like to think about the potential in people. And then you see something like that and you're like, oh my God, anybody at any time could snap. I'm thinking about writing something set. I think I'll go back and do the first Watts riot because I have a kind of a family story connected to that that I think I might write a novel set then and hope they'll get to explore that, both the concept of the police and the anger that goes towards that a little more in that.
Now, in The Wolf of Bordeaux, you had to exercise some different muscles in writing about the past, and now you exercise some different muscles in the story. After all, you're writing about a near future post-apocalyptic scenario.
What I wanted to write there was a campfire story. I envisioned it as being told by someone, an old guy telling a story around a campfire. The language is kind of deteriorated into this sort of, you know, people are dropping their G's and it kind of turning into an old westy kind of diction that they have. And I chose to do that because I wanted to make sure there was separated out from now and that you knew there was this distance, but not be too obvious. You know, I wanted it to sit in there. And that's set in like a post-apocalyptic Bakersfield. They go to this place called Lake Isabella. It's not really named in the story, but that was the map I had in my head there. And I'd never tried to do anything like that. And I mean, I wasn't even really thinking of it as a post-apocalyptic. That wasn't the structure I was thinking of. I was just more, once again, into these characters, a father-son story, and trying to find a way into telling a father-son story that would be a little different than a realistic modern-day father-son thing. I just kind of wanted to stretch it a little bit. It was a fun experiment. You know, I don't know if I would ever go into the science fiction. I mean, that's how I started out reading. When I was a kid, that's all I read was science fiction until I was about 14 or so. And I think I read On the Road, I remember reading that. And suddenly I saw that, like, this guy's writing about real life, regular life, and it's, to me as a kid then, it was as exciting as the science fiction stuff I'd been reading. And it really just, I mean, literally that one book killed it. I don't think I ever read another science fiction book again, and I started to discover people like Steinbeck and Hemingway, and I was like 14, 15, just going to the paperback bookstore and, you know, pulling books off and sort of self-educating. We didn't have the internet then, so just kind of self-educating, and that's when I began to start to figure out what I wanted to do as a writer.
But you can see the Grapes of Wrath in After All a bit,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, well, that's my family history. I mean, they came out from Missouri and Oklahoma and Arkansas from right after World War One up and through the Dust Bowl. That's when they all sort of migrated out to California, and I still have tons of relatives in Missouri. My grandma's buried in Licking Springs, Missouri. We have relatives in Arkansas. I don't have a lot of contact with them. I mean, I know my dad moved back to live near people, and he lives in Branson, Missouri, on the border with Arkansas. We aren't close, but he has contact with, you know, the relatives who stayed out here and have been here forever. So those stories were always almost seemed personal, because I would hear those kind of stories from my relatives about when they, my grandpa was a hobo named Kid Raines, and I think he started out in Arkansas, and then he ended up in El Paso, and finally ended up in Stockton, or a little town outside Stockton called Manteca, and these old family stories, and that's going to stick in your head and come out somewhere. So I guess that story is a good place to start dealing with that stuff.
Well, and my family's from Missouri and Arkansas, mm-hmm. both. And my grandmother's sister married a man, and they went out to Oroville, mm-hmm. and he helped build the dam, mm-hmm. at mm-hmm. Oroville.
Yeah, that's what a lot of, you know...
WPA
Yeah,
stuff.
I had relatives who came out to work on the aqueduct that brought water down from Northern California to Southern California. It was a huge, huge project that took years. And so there were a lot of people working on that, the Hoover Dam. I think that was it. There was work out there back then. It drew a lot of people from this part of the country.
Probably the biggest theme in all these stories is loss, and how a big central loss can cascade and just almost ruin a person.
I don't have a lot to regret in my life. Like, I've like made the right choices, and I've been lucky not to have a ton of tragedy in my personal life. But I think that perhaps because I haven't, I'm terrified of it. And so maybe that's why I tend to write about it so much. Almost in a way, it's like practicing. You know, like if I feel like if I write these things out, the worst things that can happen and the feelings that you would have and the things that maybe I'm getting it over with, so when it finally does happen to me, as it's going to happen to everybody, you know, terrible things are going to happen to you, that, you know, I've kind of built up the strength, or at least it's not going to hit me in the face, which I'm sure it will. But my hope, you know, my naive hope is that perhaps by doing this, when I try to figure out why do I write about that, this is what I tell myself, that perhaps that in a naive way, I'm thinking that I'm, by writing about these things, that I haven't experienced that kind of loss, but by dealing with it, you know, in that methody actor way where you're making yourself feel it, that I'm strengthening myself for when I actually do, and I'll be able to handle it better. It's kind of a weird explanation, but that's the closest explanation that I can get to why, you know, I obsessively deal with loss, and I haven't really had that kind of thing in my life. So I can only assume that's it. Maybe a psychologist or someone could, you know, probably dig deeper and have something more to say about that.
Well, I thought it was really interesting because there's a second theme that also alters lives, often in a bad way in the story, and that's unintended pregnancies. A lot of these people have gotten pregnant, have been forced to get married. There's shotgun weddings all over the place, and you see how it's kind of like cascaded down and really affected their lives.
Well, that's probably more close to my life. Because my mom, she met my dad when she was 12. She got married when she was 16. And I think that I might have been the reason. But, you know, and I was born because I was born when she was 17. And so I had never noticed that. But if that's in there, that's definitely part of, you know, my family history, that a young mother, young father, and the consequences that come from that, because those kind of things definitely shaped my life as I was growing up.
The narrator of Baby Killer, she becomes pregnant, and then her daughter gets mm-hmm. pregnant as a teenager, must come down. Mm-hmm. Narrator, he and his wife got pregnant before they were married, and it went along, and let's see,
Gather Darkness.
We got all sorts of marriages, pregnancies out of wedlock there.
Which is funny, because I don't have any kids either. So it's weird for me when I write about kids, because once again, I'm imagining a life that I don't have. I mean, I have nieces. I've watched closely as my sisters raise them and the things that she's gone through. And, you know, once again, you're sort of being an empath. You're putting yourself in and you're thinking, what would I do if my kid did this? What would I do if my kid said that? Putting myself in the kids' minds. And so it's that whole thing about assuming the inner life of these characters.
I don't think the stories are nihilistic, but when you have this approach that a loss can ruin your life and a birth can ruin your life, is there any hope?
You know, I leave that to the reader. I don't see these stories as hopeless as some other people do. I mean, some of them, yeah, they do end badly. Some of them end in this stasis point where you're not sure it can go one way or the other. And in some of them, I try to, at least, I'm trying to think of one that I could give you right now, where I try to leave you with a glimmer, that something...
Apocrypha.
Yeah, there you go. You know, he's a security guard, down on his luck. But at the end of the story, his main thing is, I'm just going to keep to the straight and narrow. He's straight. He's been in prison. And he's trying very hard to stay on the straight and narrow. He's tempted. At the jewelry store he works at, he's tempted to get involved, but he doesn't. He keeps to the straight and narrow, even though it gets him in a little bit of trouble. But, yeah, there you go. That's an example. But that's the main message that I could deliver to anybody.
Well, and in Sweet Nothing, there is a moment that's just really two moments that transcend. There's something horrible that happens in the story, too.
Yeah.
Two positives to one negative, so that's pretty good for
that
story.
Yeah, I mean, if I was going to offer advice, from these stories, I mean, my advice seems to be you got to keep going. You know, no matter what, you just keep moving forward and, you never give up. You can despair, but you don't give up. One foot in front of the other, move through each day, and that's kind of the solution that these people have. They have such bad things have happened to them in their past that's a victory for them, is to keep moving forward and not screw up again.
There's one sentence that pops up in the story, instinctive drowning response. Mary Rose dies on Wednesday. And that sentence comes almost every other big paragraph break. And it's that idea that helps us know that it's constantly in the narrator's mind. But just because you repeat it every other time, it doesn't stop the action from moving forward. We still see the entirety of his life, but we see that. And the fact that you have that sentence in the present tense shows how constant and present it is mind all the time.
Wow, you make me seem smarter than I am. I mean, on that one, I was just kind of trying to, I said, well, all these stories are going pretty straightforward. And I wanted to experiment a little with form, with busting up time. So I tried to come up with some sort of device to do that. But now that you say that, that's a great analyzation of stuff. But, that often happens with writers. I mean, at least me, because I write so instinctually. It's just, I could never explain how I do what I do. It just had some guy asked me once, like, how did you write that sentence? Some sentence from Dead Boys or something. You knew exactly what you were doing, the way you turned that at the end. And he might have had some technical term for it. And I'm like, man, I just sit down and I start writing. And I've read a lot. When I'm reading, I sort of absorb and I'm conscious of what people are doing. And so perhaps that's where you pick up the things. But it's never like when you were saying, like, oh, I'm going to have this guy do this because it's present in his mind. But that's a beautiful interpretation of it. I mean, I love that. I always like when the readers point out something to me that perhaps was subconscious, as we're talking about the mother, the birth thing. I mean, that's always interesting to me because we were talking earlier and I said in the first book, Dead Boys, I didn't even realize there were themes in it until they all came together because I'm so involved in the individual projects. And for me, I'm involved in the individual paragraphs and sentences. And so sometimes when I get to the end, I've completely sort of lost sight of what I've created, like what's there. It's just, I can feel that I'm done and here's this thing. And it's a mysterious process.
Earlier this year, I interviewed this guy named Scott Blackwood. He teaches at Southern Illinois University. Mm-hmm. He has this book called See How Small. And it's basically kind of a reworking of a true crime that happened in Austin, Texas, where four girls were murdered in a yogurt shop in the early 90s.
I remember the crime.
And so this is kind of a recasting of that, but it's looking at how the crime has affected everybody for the couple of years after. And there's one character whose father makes movie sets, and his stepfather makes glass eyeballs, prosthetic eyes.
Yeah.
And so, and I just thought that was, one is to fool the eye,
yeah,
and the other one is to fool that there is an eye.
Wow.
And he's going, oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, you're the kind of reader that every writer wants, you know, who's actually paying attention.
So before we started the interview, you were talking about your previous career, and you worked at Hustler magazine with Larry Flint.
I started out, I went to film school at USC. I got a scholarship there. I don't know how, because I was from a, you know, poor, oaky family. Somehow I got in there, and everybody else in there, they were the sons and daughters of directors and producers and things like that. And I had a naive idea about film. I didn't understand that it's collaborative, and that when you get in there, you're working with a team, and that just wasn't, you know, what I really wanted to do. So I kind of got into fiction writing through a guy named T.C. Boyle. And I took some a couple fiction writing classes.
That's a big name to throw down there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's been very helpful to me along the way in a lot of ways. But he was like the first real writer I met. And what I liked about him is that he's a very normal guy. I mean, you can talk to him, you know, just... I mean, he does have a kind of an act he puts on, but once you get through that, he's a very normal guy. He came from a similar background to me, so it was, oh, so you don't have to be, you know, some East Coast John Updike character to be a writer. You can be this guy who's from a hardscrabble town and do that. So he's kind of what got me started. So I decided I was going to be a writer. After college, I tried to write screenplays. I tried to write a novel, and I couldn't get even anybody to look at the stuff. So I ended up taking a job at a bookstore, and then someone came into the bookstore and said, oh, you know how to read. Do you want to work for Larry Flynn as a copy editor? So I'd never been a copy editor, and so I went home and taught myself the copy editing symbols out of the back. They used to have a page in the back of the dictionary that listed. So I went in, I took the test, somehow I passed, and I ended up working for Larry Flynn. And for the first year, I worked on Hustler and Chic and the porn stuff, and then he started buying other magazines and starting magazines. And so after I was there, you started a heavy metal music magazine called Rip. And I ended up working on that as managing editor for 7 years.
I read Rip in my teenage years, yeah.
Yeah. So I was the managing editor, which means my boss was a guy who went out and golfed with Motley Crue and went on the road with Def Leppard. And I stayed in the office in L.A. and put the magazine together. And editing was a great training ground for being a writer, because at that job, you were taking music writers who, at least the ones we had, weren't the greatest writers in the world, and you have to really heavily edit them to make them coherent. The job I had after that was at a trade paper, which you're probably familiar with, called Radio and Records. Mm-hmm. And I worked there for 10 years as managing editor. And that's a radio trade paper. It's kind of like which DJs got hired and fired. It has charts. It has articles about the radio business. And I knew nothing about that. My job was to take all the writing that came in, edit it, make it coherent, which a lot of it was coming from ex-DJs and, these guys who aren't writers. And once again, it was great practice in constructing stuff and keeping it tight and putting it all together into something that in a semi-coherent form. I got my book contract for Dead Boys and a novel to be written, because I hadn't written a novel yet. About a week after that, Billboard bought Radio and Records and killed it. You know, that was their competition. Billboard and Radio Records were competitors. So, you know, it's that corporate thing. They bought the competitor and killed the magazine. So I lost my job like the week after I'd signed the contract. That was, you know, one of the incredible strokes of luck that I've had that have allowed me to keep going as a writer rather than go back to a day job.
Then you have a small connection to Memphis, because The People versus Larry Flint, much of it was filmed here in Memphis.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And I was an extra.
Oh, I know Larry Kay and Scott, who wrote the script. Larry was a friend from USC. I've been seeing him a lot lately. And yeah, I didn't know they filmed that here.
Yeah, I was in the second scene. The first scene is them as children in Kentucky. Then the next scene is when they're opening up one of the Hustler clubs.
Yeah.
And I'm one of the cheesy patrons sitting there sipping on a Sprite with an olive in it.
Next time I run through that, I'll have to look for you.
I got to use Milos Forman's cell phone.
Oh, wow.
Because they kept us long.
Did they have cell phones then?
Yeah, it was like a Nokia.
Yeah, wasn't it like a walkie-talkie or something?
But with growing up in a way with a string of stepfathers and then being tangential to the film industry, going to film school, and then being involved with Larry Flint, you said you've made good choices. So that must have been pretty hard, because you've had all these opportunities to kind of go astray.
Yeah, you know, my mom wasn't a great mom, but if she did impress upon me one thing, it was this idea that we were talking about earlier. You have to get up every day and you have to go to work. Like, no matter what, there's no excuse. And for me, there was a lot of, in the beginning, I know a lot of people who had problems after college. I know a million drug addicts, and they were all the sons of rich men, because USC is a very rich school. And they never had to have a job. They never had to, you know, worry about falling all the way down. Whereas when I left home at 17, my parents said, we're done. Goodbye. You know, they didn't give me any money for school. They didn't give me any money for living. So I worked in a supermarket for 5 years of my college. I started as a bag boy and then became a night manager at this crazy supermarket in South Central, which in my first book, I write a story about that. Seems like there's a lot of supermarkets that show up my stuff, but because I did work for so long in one and learned as much there as I ever learned in college. You're a much better psychologist than me, but the reason why I think that I never took those is because I was so damn scared of having to move home. A, it would have been impossible, but B, I didn't have a safety net. So I think it began out of fear, like, and I had good training because my mom, you know, as bad as she was, she did get up and go to work every day. You know, all that, she might have hated her job, she might have been hungover as hell, but she got up and went to work. So I think I had that kind of ethic instilled in me, and I still can't get away with it. When I first became a writer, full-time writer, we were talking about Chris Offutt earlier, who's a writer that a lot of people know. And, you know, I told him, well, Chris, you know, I don't know, I feel weird. Like, I can do whatever I want. I don't have to go to a job. I can sit here and lay around all day. And he said, you're a writer. If you write one thing today, you wrote. You know, I mean, luckily I'm a little better. I'm a little more disciplined than that.
I don't know if you should take writing advice from Chris Offutt when it comes to putting out books.
You're right. He takes a little time between them, but when he does them, they're good.
Are you working on a novel right now?
Yeah. A lot of weird stuff has happened over the last year or two because Hollywood finally got involved and they bought Angel Baby, which was my last novel. And they hired me to write the screenplay. So that was a diversion. Now I have agents and they want me to write. I've wrote a couple TV pilots because the money is phenomenal. It's so much better than book money. And I'm already too old to be getting into the film business. But if I can ride that wave as long as possible, I hope to be able to make enough money to finance my book writing. You know, I'll never have to sweat to worry about going back to a day job again if I can just get, you know, five or six good projects. So it's been a little bit of a diversion trying, like, deciding how much to chase that and how much to work on the book that I do owe my publisher. And I'm halfway through it. You know, I go back to it when there is a little downtime. It takes me about a year and a half or 2 years to write a novel of solid, straight work. I just told my Hollywood agents that I'm rewriting a script. That's the way you can make money. You rewrite scripts that are bad. They say, well, you're a real writer. Here, you know, take this script that's
crap. Do your Faulkner to it.
Yeah, and make this good. So that's a way that you can make a living doing that. You could just keep doing that if you were good enough at it. So I think that's going to be my last Hollywood job for a while. We'll see, unless they offer me something big. But I'm going to go back to the novel and finish it up. And it was due in July. I had them push it to January, which I hated to do that because, you know, I've got that workman thing. I want to give them the project when I told them I'd give it to them. But they're very understanding in the book business about why writers work in film, because they know the money they pay and they know the money that Hollywood pays. And if you want to make a living as a writer, it certainly helps to have Hollywood money behind you. You know, I don't want to teach. I don't even have an MFA or anything. So it'd be tricky teaching, and I know so many people out there that are trying to get teaching jobs that are infinitely more qualified than me. So I don't want to even have to think about that. I don't want to go back to editing because I don't know if that job even exists anymore. In the age of the internet, it might be.
You could pick up some freelance editing the self-published authors.
I read stuff online. I'm like, nobody has looked at this. You know, this has just come directly out of, you know, a non-writer onto the screen. So I know magazine publishing, which I did, is pretty much gone. So yeah, whatever I can do to not have to go out as a 53-year-old man and try to find a day job would be, I'm up for that.
And it seems now that series TV is the medium for a more mature writer because they actually can talk about grown-ups and grown-up stuff on those.
It's weird when I first got these Hollywood people. You know, in the old days, it was like, oh, write a spec script, which means you're going to write a script that nobody's paid you for, but it's going to be your calling card to get you other jobs. That one might not get made, but it'll show people what you can do. Now, when you go in, when I went in, they said, write a pilot. Because, yeah, and my agents in Hollywood specialize in getting book writers into TV. They're Nick Pizzolatto, who did True Detective. Through them is how he worked and you know, came from being a book writer to being like the biggest guy in TV right now. So, but they do. They direct you to write. They want you to write pilots now and series. Just, and I think that's true. I mean, I used to make fun of TV, you know, when I was younger. It was like, it was all terrible. And now,
yeah.
Right. And now, you know, I watch all the shows that everybody else does and they're better than movies. You know, movies have now become, you know, most films are geared towards kids or teenagers and their big tentpole budget things. And for me, having worked so long in telling stories, I can sit down in a movie and from the first, most movies, the first scene, you know exactly where it's going to go all the way because they've all read the same book, you know, Save the Cat.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Save the Cat, or whatever it's called. Like, they exactly follow the beats. And I'm not interested, at least in TV. Look at True Detective, for example, that you could do things that were structurally and thematically a little more mature and different and extend the story over a long time.
And novelists are well suited for that because they know how to sustain that interest over 350 pages.
Yeah, it's definitely where they're pushing novel writers when they go into the film TV business.
So any interest on any of the short stories for but a film? Because that seems what short stories are really well suited toward.
Just got an email, two emails since I've been here in Memphis from people because the book's just, this book just came out, the book of short stories, Sweet Nothing, came out a couple months ago. So finally people are getting around to reading it and I'm starting to get the emails. You know, I don't know if that'll ever happen. There was the most interesting project that came up was a woman from Luxembourg wrote me and was going to do a story from the first book of short stories in Luxembourgish, which I didn't even know was a language.
Is it Luxembourgish?
Luxembourgish, well, yeah.
I think it's Luxembourgish.
Is it? Luxembourgish? Yeah. And she was going to do a film, and so she, you know, optioned the rights, but she never got the grant that she was going to get from the government to do it, and so that project never happened. But I was like, that'd be great, you know, to have one of these gritty stories from L.A. transformed into. And then another interesting, a French guy was going to buy one and make a short film taking a story from the first book and setting it in an Arab neighborhood, a poor French Arab neighborhood, which I thought that would have been fantastic. I would love to have seen how that would have translated. But yeah, you get nibbles, but it's, do they want to pay? You know, and early on in my career, when I didn't even have an agent, a guy read a story in a magazine and I sold it to him completely forever for like $1,500. Like, he owns one of the stories and Dead Boys, everything,
yeah.
Which, you should not do that. You should have a limit. Like, you can have it for 3 months and an option. And I didn't. I just sold it outright to him. So I'm wary now. And luckily, I have professionals now that take care of that stuff for me because obviously I'm a terrible businessman when it comes to that stuff.
Well, Richard, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm glad. Thanks for having me. I mean, I was so happy that anybody would care here in Memphis about me.
Richard Lang is the author of the short story collection Sweet Nothing, which is published by Mulholland Books. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.